This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. My name is Patsy Gill, coming to you from WTAN 1340, Tampa Bay's Tantalk Radio Network. Now, my first guest today is somebody really special, Angie Sage. Angie, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Hi. Oh, it's so great to talk to you.
Hi.
You know, it's amazing.
I
remember when your first book came out because my boys were young. They're now in university, but at the time, of course, it was your the beginning of your fantastic series about Septimus Heap, and it was, of course, called Magic. And I remember thinking I knew it was magic simply because of the way you spell the word. Tell us, how did you do that? Why did you do that? You spelled it in a special way.
Well, it was one of the really first things I decided was that I wanted magic to be different from our magic today, because I think today we just see magic as tricks and conjurers, and it doesn't have that kind of deep kind of almost scariness, but it doesn't have the weight that I wanted the magic in the books to have. So what I did was I actually used old English spelling. And, you know, before we all had a dictionary, people did spell in the most peculiar ways, and they often spelled magic like this, or they would end it with a CK. So all the words to do with magic, I decided to use an old English version, so the next
M A G Y K
in it.
That's
right. So yeah, old English spelling.
It's lovely, and of course you followed that through. Now, for those people who how they could have missed this, your books, I don't know, because they were bestsellers all over the place. But Septimus Heap is a series of 7 books. Right?
Yes, absolutely.
And each of them with their own unique spelling of words. Now, 7, of course, has a significance for you in the Septimus Heap, and then we'll go on to your new series. But why 7 for Septimus?
Well, I borrowed it, really. It is a significant number, but I think it is in our culture and in our legends and myths, 7 is a magical number and has been for hundreds and probably thousands of years. So I took that. It's it's a melting pot a book is, and into it goes all kinds of things that you think will go to make this new world. So I took the number 7 because I think it's a great number. There's lots of things you can do with it, and it relates to lots of things. And of course, Septimus's name is what people tend to call, or used to in the old days, call their 7th child. If he was a boy, it'd be Septimus. So
he was the 7th son of the 7th son. And
he was, yes.
And you wrote 7 books
indeed
about him. Now,
yeah.
Of course, fantastic bestsellers. They were on best-selling lists all over the world. I know that they've been published in I don't know how many languages by now, and a fantastic series. And then you took how many years was it between the time you finished those books and you decided, and I'm sure by great demand from your fans, you started a second series. And tell us about this second series. And I know today is actually, I think, the release of your second book in this new series.
It is, yes. It's the release day for Sand Rider. And it was in response to fans and also a feeling that I had that the series wasn't quite done. But I wanted to stop at 7 because it felt right. And also my characters were getting older, they were getting into teens. And so my writing was going to have to change to follow them through. And I still wanted my younger age group to be able to read the books. So I went with a lovely character, Alice Todd Hunter Moon, who I'd glimpsed in the last book, In Fire, looking out of her attic window in her fisherman's hut where she lived. And she was kind of wistful and sad. And I knew that there was things I wanted to write about her and that she was a character that I wanted to get to know better. And so we got to know Alice Todd Hunter Moon, who likes to be known as Todd. And this trilogy is just a year in her life, and it follows her discovery of all kinds of things, but particularly of the existence of the castle and Septimus and that world, and she comes into that world. And so we see it through new eyes. And then Sand Rider is as she gets her confidence in that world, and she actually goes off on quite a scary adventure in search of an Orm egg, which is actually quite important that she finds it. So we have a countdown to the Orm egg hatching running through Sand Rider.
Well, I think it's great that you may, yeah. You know, you have now in this new series a female protagonist and one,
yeah.
But yet you bring back so many of the characters from the first series, so that all the sort of beloved ones and maybe not beloved,
yes,
ones.
The old favorite.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, you know, your writing is what I call really, and this is a great compliment for me, solid writing, in that you're such a good writer that so often when you pick up a book about fantasy and there's a problem with the actual writing, and so you start worrying,
yeah,
about is it grammatically correct or is it this, you know, but your writing is so solid and so beautiful and so compelling, and it's you know, goes beyond what sort of the normal writing of any novels nowadays. And you know what I love, you have a fantastic sense of humor, and this really there's so many things in your books, and there are so many funny things and so many clever things. Well, you know, it's like you're living sort of writing down dreams, I have a feeling, or sort of wild imagination that you must have.
It's a strange thing. I mean, when I write, it comes to me, and I can't think of it beforehand, and I can't think of it away from the computer. It really is. It's like I have to be in the groove. I have to be in that world, and then the stuff begins to work. And it's a strange alchemy. I don't know how it happens, really.
Well, you know,
I'm just glad it does.
Well, you have been touched by magic. It's funny, you know. I was reading that you're, you know, of course, British, and living in some of your inspiration came from Cornwall. Is that correct?
Cornwall, yes, absolutely. In fact, I'm there today.
Oh, okay.
It's a magical place, actually.
You know, when I was young, I'm from Michigan, northern Michigan, but my life was,
yeah,
centered around reading books, and mostly reading books about, you know, by British authors. And so I always dreamed about living in England. And when I was old enough, in my 20s, when I made my first money, the first thing I did with my money was I bought a cottage in Sonning, which is, you know, just...
No, in Sonning.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
I bought St. Anne's Cottage.
Lovely.
I bought St. Anne's Cottage opposite the sweet shop in Sonning. And I
how lyrical. I'm storing such a beautiful play.
Oh, it is. It in itself is magical. But the wonderful thing about this cottage, which was a 400-year-old cottage, is that when I bought it, I walked in, I loved it, and I paid the estate agent almost immediately. I wrote a check for it. And I did not even think about anything until I had to get some repairs done and changes because some crazy people had put plastic tiling over the beams. You know, 400-year-old ship beams. People had put. So anyway, I was having the place ripped apart, and they opened up the floor, and there was a pit 40 feet deep below my living room floor, and I can tell you.
No.
Yes, and I mean, of course, the builder said, "Oh, you've got to fill it up. You have to do this. You know," but I was so magical. Was so magical. I said, I don't want to fill it up. I mean, I want to know that it's down there. I don't know. You know, maybe.
No.
And I wish now I had your imagination. I probably would have written a maybe not a bestseller like you, but at least a story. And I might still come back to it because after reading your books, you have given so much joy to so many people, and it's funny that, you know, I know they're written for, they're sort of advertised for a sort of a young, very young group, but my boys were, I don't know, they were like 11 or something like that, 12 when they read the book, and they loved the book. So it was, and I really think anybody will enjoy your books because it's the cleverness of it. I love all the little clever things, whether it's, well, of course, I love your use of things like Queen Ethelreda. You know, and sort of.
Oh, she's a one. She's a player. Yes.
Well, you weave in real history, sort of real historical names, and I hope it opens up the imagination to people who maybe will actually go and go and look up some of this, and it's beautifully done.
Thank you so much. And it, I do write it for all ages, and I'm so glad that, you know, it comes across that way, because I know it is said 9 to 12, but honestly, I write for everybody, and I've got a lot of grown-up readers and late teens, you know. So, yes, I just write what I would like to read, I think, in the end.
And, you know, all of your characters, I mean, there's so many. I don't even know where to start. You know, I do just want to mention that I loved Marcia Overstrand. And then of course all of the little clever things that you come out with, like foot following. Can you explain that? I just need you to explain that to people. What foot following means?
Yes. So that's a witchy thing.
Yes.
And it's a way of following somebody who doesn't want to be followed, but you have to step in their footsteps. You have to step into three, and then you're off. And after that, the great twist, because there's always a twist in this dark magic, is that you have no choice. You have to go where they've gone. So I think in Fire, the person being followed, who's Jenna, walks up her landing stage and then comes back. But the witch is following her, but she has to go past her and come back. And also, if the person happens to fall off a cliff, you know, the follower falls off the cliff as well. So it's a mixed blessing, as so it should be as well.
Well, I loved your when you're talking about approaching a dragon. And you mentioned wolverine fur. Where did you come up with that idea?
I don't know. I see wolverines in my mind, rather feral, nasty, kind of scrawny, wolf-like things.
Yes, but they're not British. And it's so funny because coming from Michigan is called the Wolverine State. So in
is it? I didn't. They exist, don't they? But I have no idea.
Well, they do exist
in real life.
And I was so surprised. You know, I had never seen anybody write Wolverine fur, and it was so cute. I thought, whoa!
It's particularly smelly Wolverine fur. I think you know if you're wearing it.
That's it. It's those kind of details, those kind of little things that really make your books so full. So you know, one can read them and then one can go back and read it again and find new things. And I think that's why, of course, you have such a enormous fan base. And I'm sure they're all excited about the new book. And you're in Cornwall. Are you doing a tour to?
No, I'm staying home actually, and it's lovely. I'm talking to you on the radio, and I'm writing. I'm sort of thinking and writing, which is great, and it's nice actually just have some space to think. So it's been great though with the book coming out and sort of connecting with lots of people about it. But I'm actually this time I'm staying back in England.
Well, but I think
I do hope to be over to the States one day soon.
Well, you know, I think that, I mean, your fan base is enormous, and it must be. Do you have the books in all the different languages they've published it in? You have like a bookshelf full.
Yes,
it must be so.
Just to see them in the different languages, I just get such a thrill from that. It really is. Yes, it makes me realize how many people have read them.
Well, it is.
It's very strange because when you sit at home on your own and write, you don't think of lots of people reading. It's only when you see the book you realize that, wow. Yeah, lots of people are reading this, so it's a real privilege, actually.
Well, you know, my program is called Joy on Paper because I love to see people writing. I love people to encourage people to write and to read, and because there's so much, it's so thrilling when somebody, you know, I talk a lot to writers and I say, just sit down and start writing and let your imagination go. Write what you think. Yeah. Write what you see in your head, and it's amazing. As you said, you sit down at the computer and it starts sort of flowing out, and that's, you know, a thrilling feeling, isn't it?
It is, and you have to actually. It sounds so obvious, but it took me years to realize that I have to actually sit down at the computer and I have to write. It doesn't work just thinking about it. You have to physically press the keys and do it, or write with your pen. But
exactly what
I
you
think through computer.
We're no longer Tolstoy that we can sit down and write thousands of pages by hand. but it is thrilling.
Unfortunately, that's true.
But it's thrilling with the speed of
getting.
I love seeing the words sort of just flowing out there. And, of course, you go back. There's rewriting. Yes.
Yes, there's a lot of rewriting, yes. But that's great. That's good. It's like sculpting. It's making your story work and making it, you know, more beautiful. It's really important to go back and revisit and rework. And I think, you know, it gives you time to think as well. So I actually quite like editing.
Well, it is fun. It is fun, actually. Even for the best writers, the first time, you know, you get your idea down and then you go back and you make these little changes that just, sometimes you just amaze yourself. You say, whoa, I did that, you know.
Yes.
It's an exciting feeling. And that's why I always...
It is.
You know, I tell writers, don't, you know, like write it once and then go back, and you'll find each time, you know, something more will come through. And it's amazing what people can do if they really try. And of course, well, you don't.
It is. And you just have to allow yourself a bit of time and give yourself that time, excuse me, to write, because I think sometimes one can feel that maybe you should be doing other things, but it is really important to make some space and just get a bit of quiet time to sit down and allow it to happen.
Well, you know, as of course, I know that you have an enormous... you've sold so many books, and you're going to sell so many more. And I, as a, someone who's written quite a few screenplays and had quite a few, quite a few of them optioned.
Really?
Oh yes, but wow. I know what I think you've been going through with the your books, and you know it is. So I am sure that eventually this your series is going to make a fantastic movie.
I do hope so, and I actually think it would make a fantastic TV series.
Yes, you know that's
got that depth. I could see it as a box set. You know, I just think it would be great.
And I know they've put it in some kind of turnaround, which sort of spins you in circles. But I think that you know your fans are waiting, and they will be there when the studio finally gets their act together and gets your.
They will. They've set up a petition, and I know they want it. But everything has to be right,
and it comes you know, at it has to come at it will say. because I know that
yes.
you have such an enormous fan base, and that's. That's the you know in the end that can make a big box office. So I hope that the people in Hollywood, and I know they've given you a sort of runaround in the past year or so, but you know it happens. Sometimes people make more money on being optioned than they actually do when the film is made. So, but I hope that. We will be able to see, you know, certainly Septimus Heap in the future. And the new series, I think, you know, you with the new series and with Alice Todd Hunter Moon, which I love that name. It's a fantastic name.
Yes, I love it too. It's a long name, but it suits her.
Exactly. It's you know you come out you have so many clever names and you know sometimes people can come out with clever names that don't are just too clever, you know, too cute. But your names are so apropos to each of the characters, and it makes them so memorable. So I just want to thank you so much. I hope that. Well, I know you're going to have great sales with the new book. And
thank you.
And everybody should, of course, go to your webpage. Do you want to mention your webpage?
Well, my webpage is a building site at the moment. So if you go to my Facebook page, I've got an Angie Sage author page, and I've got a personal Facebook page. And if anybody wants to know anything, you can tweet me at Angie Sage Author. And I always reply to tweets.
And I love your name too, by the way. I love the name Angie Sage.
Thank you.
I thought I wasn't sure if you made that up too, because it's a perfect name.
No, I really didn't. It's by marriage, but it truly is my name.
Well, it suits you. It's as I said, when I first came across the name, I said, "Oh, well, that's a clever name to make up, you know, for a British author." And of course, it is wonderful. And I know that you were an illustrator beforehand, so you must be really thrilled with the illustrations that have come out of your book. And
I adore Mark Zug's illustrations. They are just perfection.
They are, absolutely.
I couldn't ask for anything better. He's so talented.
Well, I want to...
He just gets everything perfectly.
He did. He captured
it. Gift.
Well,
yes.
I want to encourage everyone to go today, because today is the release of your new book, and it's book two in this new series. and get it. It's available on Amazon and all over the you know, places where you buy books online. But I like to be on Amazon and write a review, because I'm sure you're going to get some fantastic reviews. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And
thank you.
I just love thinking of you there in Cornwall. And next time you pass through Sonning, look there at St. Anne's Cottage and remember me. Okay?
I will. It's such a beautiful place.
Absolutely.
Oh, how lovely.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me today. And I look forward to talking to you when book 3 comes out.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Have a
good day. Bye. Bye, Angie.
Bye.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy a lifestyle to fit your needs. From independent living, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing. Our exciting independent lifestyle is the perfect combination of freedom, comfort, and security. Enjoy total independence with peace of mind. Our independent lifestyle includes chef-prepared meals in our beautiful waterfront dining room, a continental breakfast, all utilities, including cable and telephone, housekeeping with linen service, scheduled transportation, including trips for shopping, local restaurants, theater, and more. Our activities program is second to none. At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy affordable luxury waterfront senior living with a million-dollar view. Call today, 727-445-4069, and discover where caring, compassionate service really makes the difference.
Are you looking for some great restaurants? For some great wines? Where are the great chefs? Listen to Dine Out Radio Herd every Wednesday on the TAN Talk Radio Network. 12 to 1 p.m., we'll tell you where all the great events are. We'll have Food and Wine Magazine and Bon Appetit Magazine. We'll have their editors and writers on each month. And maybe we'll throw in a couple surprises. Check out the website, diningoutradio.com.
My bridge is all...
There's only one place on the radio where golfers like you can turn for the best tips, interviews, product reviews, local tournaments, and everything golf talk. The Golf Show, guys.
Hey, join the Golf Show, guys, every Wednesday morning from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. It's not just funny. It's informative. It's celebrities. And it's a lot of applause. It's the Golf Show, guys, Wednesday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. right here on the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Deborah Johnson. Hi, Deborah, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Patsy. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining me today. I want to tell my audience that your book, The Secret of Magic, is the winner of the 2015 Harper Lee Prize for Fiction. And, of course, you're going to be here in Tampa Bay area. You're going to be at the Festival of Reading on October 24th here. That is sponsored by the Tampa Bay Times. So we're very excited that you're coming to town to talk about your book.
Thank you. I'm excited to come. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, I don't know. I almost want to start crying when I talked to you because I was like, when I read on your webpage, which I thought was such a beautiful tribute to your grandfather. So we'll talk first, before we talk about the book, which is a fantastic book, I want to talk about your grandfather, to whom, of course, the inspiration for the book comes a great deal from him. And I loved the way you wrote about him. And so tell us about your grandfather.
Well, my grandfather signed up, I think it was even actually December 8th or 9th of 1941, to go fight against the Nazis and the fascists in the Second World War, when effectively he did not have the right to vote here in his own country. But he loved the United States so much, he loved the idea of democracy so much, that he really wanted to be a part of that liberation, and was a part of it. And he was always an inspiration to me, just his very life, but also the fact that he'd done this, that we had a photograph of him in his uniform that he'd given to my grandmother, and that I have now, and that is actually on the web page. And so I always knew, because of him, that I wanted to write about the Second World War and the significant changes that it began. And also, since his idol was Thurgood Marshall, I knew that I wanted to write about Thurgood Marshall and the early days of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund as well. So that's what the inspiration, those two things were the main inspiration for the book.
So, of course, your grandfather, it was your maternal grandfather. His name is Joe Howard Thurman, and I think, I want to mention it so that people know and can remember that name, because he certainly influenced you and influenced the way that you have come out with this fantastic book.
I love what I loved
about it. Well, of course, it's called The Secret of Magic, and I love when there's I always like books where there's a mysterious letter. And it always sort of thrills me, because I'm always sort of, I love to go, to garage sales and antique stores, and I always pick up old letters, because I like it. I like to see the, first of all, the handwriting, you know, from the old days.
Yes.
And then, of course, you have, tell us about the opening of it, about Regina Robichard, and who works for Thurgood Marshall in your book.
Yes, Regina Robichard is based on an idol of mine, who was Constance Baker Motley, who was the first woman hired by Thurgood Marshall at the Legal Defense Fund. She graduated law school in 1946. She was hired, I think, in 1945. So this, you know, significantly long ago, that they were already thinking about advancing women. And in the book, Regina Robichard receives a letter from a woman. She doesn't know it's a woman at the time, but a person named M.P. Calhoun, who asked her to come to Mississippi to investigate the murder or the disappearance of an African American soldier, an officer who had served in Europe and was on his way home from Europe, going through Alabama, when he disappeared. And it turns out that this woman, M.P. Calhoun, has written a book called The Secret of Magic, which had been one of Regina's favorite books when she was a young child, because it was the first book that she read that talked about African Americans and that had an African American on the cover, a child. And so she's very excited to go down to Mississippi to investigate this. I might also add that Joe Howard Wilson, who's based a bit on my grandfather, Joe Howard Thurman, that both of them served in a segregated army, because the army was not desegregated until, I think, 1948.
So, Regina, with this letter in hand, goes down to, and what is the name of the town? Revere?
Revere, Mississippi.
Revere, Mississippi.
Yes, Thurgood Marshall. She asked Thurgood Marshall if she can go to do preliminary investigations. And he says yes. And she goes down to Revere, Mississippi, which she's from New York, has always lived in New York, and she finds that Mississippi, which is already pretty legendary at the Legal Defense Fund and in the country, she finds it to be both better and worse in ways than what she had suspected. It would be not necessarily the same place that she thought it would be as she investigates.
Well, so many people have noted that your writing, of course, you write so beautifully, but you really make that period come alive and for the good and for the bad, that you write beautifully about some of the, you know, nice aspects of the town, and then of course the terrible things and the whole story around what happens here to this soldier. Did you have to do a lot of research? You're from Missouri, right?
Yeah, I was born in Missouri and grew up in Nebraska, and I'd actually been living in Italy for 20 years before I moved sight unseen to Mississippi. And so I did have a lot of research to do. They have really excellent archives down here. There's a lot written. But also, this is a small state without a lot of people in it. And so everybody pretty much knows their own history, and they know your history, too, if you're from here. So you learn a lot just by listening to people talk and telling their stories. And so that's how I did some of this research. Some, of course, history's my background, so I love the research. But and so most of it was done through archives. But I picked up a lot from stories as well. And I was really, and one of the things that intrigued me the most as I was doing research was a story by Charles Evers that he told. He's Medgar Evers' brother. And he lived in a small town called Decatur, Mississippi. And he talked about when he came back from serving in the Second World War, how that war, you know, fighting for independence in other countries had, or democracy at least, had sort of inspired him to want to vote in his own state. And so he had gone down to Decatur, Mississippi, to the courthouse to register. And this had stirred up so much of a backlash in his own town that he was threatened, and people were driving around in trucks with shotguns and rifles, and, you know, just because he wanted to go, you know, really definitely threatening him. And he said what made it so incredible to him and amazing and awful was the fact that the people doing this were people, the men doing this were men, boys that he had grown up with, that they'd all gone fishing and hunting together. And yet, when they hit a certain age, they went over this great divide. And that very much intrigued me.
You know, of course, the background of Thurgood Marshall and his importance in this whole period of time in putting together cases and ensuring that people became aware of the legal ramifications.
Right.
So obviously, your grandfather was a great admirer of Thurgood Marshall, on your research about him, what was particularly significant to you? What did you find maybe that was new or amazing to you? Because he was an amazing character.
Well, I mean, there's just so much. But one of the most important things was that in 1946, he was willing and did hire a woman to work at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which was, you know, not ordinary at that time at all. But the second thing that really, you know, I didn't think about, but is obviously so true, is that in 1946, in these early days, when they're fighting these battles and making these movements from individual cases to legislative action, that you know, Brown versus the Board of Education, all these victories were in the future. And there was no way that they could know that the people at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund could know that they were going to have these victories. And the work itself was very, very dangerous. And so that impressed me. The second thing that has impressed me a lot as I go around with this book is that at almost every signing I do, or every talk or event or whatever, someone comes up to me, a lawyer, and tells me that the work that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund did at that time inspired him or her to become a lawyer. And that is just so amazing, because, and I'm sure that Thurgood Marshall, no matter where he is, and all the other lawyers, are just very, very proud of this as their legacy, as part of their legacy.
Well, you've woven such a beautiful story, and of course, I think in many ways, it's going to be a classic of its kind, because it's a Southern book, and you know, it really brings the South alive. And now, when you won the award, when you won the
Harper Lee,
I don't know, it wasn't a bittersweet, so down discovery of Harper Lee at the revelations that came out afterwards.
Was it bittersweet? You mean with the next book?
Yes.
Well, you know, I read the next book as soon as it came out, and I must say that I thought that, you know, of course I always loved Atticus Finch. As I was growing up, I think To Kill a Mockingbird meant as much to me as The Secret of Magic does in the book to Regina Robichard. I just really loved Atticus Finch. But I found that Go Set a Watchman was probably a more realistic portrait of the South, at least in the 1950s. And so I like the idea that was set down, and that we can see the difference between the South in the 1950s and what it is now. In my small town, which is, you know, I think 30% African-American, the fire chief, the police chief, and the mayor, many councilmen, are African-Americans. And in the time that I'm writing about, it was very difficult, almost impossible, for an African-American to have even the right to vote. So I think that Go Set a Watchman sort of sets that time accurately.
Well, you know, I'm sure that your book touches many people in many ways. Yeah. I think the horrendous sort of being reminded of the horrendous times, mm-hmm. and then of course today we're facing things that in many ways people had thought we were over, mm-hmm. and so it must be. How do you feel about what's going on today?
You know, I think that these things were always there. They've always been lurking a little bit under the radar. And so I'm very grateful that they're being brought to people's attention in a way that they can no longer sort of hide there under the radar. That, you know, so many have happened. Our attention is focused on changes that we need to make now.
Well,
so I'm very sorry for, you know, I'm of course, you know, individually for all those families, and even the ones we don't hear about, it's going on constantly, but it has focused the national, not just ours, but the national attention on these injustices.
Well, like you, I had spent like 10 years outside of the United States, and so mm-hmm. Sometimes I miss some of it. And when I came back, I found a sort of a different perspective. And of course, now you were 20 years in Rome, which was rather exciting.
Yeah, 18 years exactly, 18. Almost 20. Yeah.
Wow. And what brought you there? You just had you studied Italian before you went and were drawn because of that, or what?
No, I actually went to study Latin. I wanted to study with the Pope's Latinist, who was a remarkable teacher. And then I just stayed. You know, things opened up, and I just stayed.
Well,
and was very happy there.
Well, that's amazing. Not too many. It's funny, when I also, in high school, I loved Latin. And so when my son was young, when he was like 7 years old, I found a Latin teacher for him.
Right.
Which was really quite unusual, but that's because I'd lived in England in a little town where all the little boys would come to the sweet shop and they'd be speaking Latin.
Right.
And so I thought, well, if they could speak Latin, you know, my son could speak Latin.
Right.
And so it's a funny thing that this sort of Latin connection of loving the language and being able to read, Caesar in Latin. So so you were a Latin scholar first, and then you became involved with the Vatican, reporting from the Vatican?
Yes, I reported. I worked in the English-speaking Africa department, and we broadcast to English-speaking Africa. And after the BBC, you know, because a lot of those countries are still in the bush, more or less. A lot of people still live there. And they get their main news through radio. And the BBC was, of course, the biggest, the most listened to, but Vatican Radio right afterwards. And so it was wonderful because we could broadcast and still, you know, see that our broadcasts made a difference in people's lives. Things would change if the Vatican took it up. And so, yes, it was a wonderful experience.
So you looked on the new Pope's visit with rather a more complete eye than most of us. It must have been exciting for you.
It was. I don't know if a more complete eye, but I certainly love him. You know, I've never met anybody who's not impressed by him, who's, you know, not his humanity and his care and his compassion, I think, have touched many people.
Well, I predict that in the future and, at some point, we're going to have a African Pope.
Oh yeah,
so many of the leaders of the Catholic Church in Africa are so very very they're so fascinating and I dare say you know quite a few of them, but I've read about some of the leaders of the Catholic Church in Africa.
Oh yeah,
who do a terrific job in
tremendous, and not just the priests. You know, I have a friend who spends a lot of time in Tanzania. He's not Catholic, but he said that no matter where he goes, no matter what outpost, no matter, you know, how far deep inside the continent it is, that if there are sick people, people with leprosy, people dying of malaria, that there are always nuns there to care for him, for these people. And how impressive this was, that the nuns, you know, are doing such good work and so selflessly.
Well, I've always envisioned an African Pope, and I'm sure that this will come about, and it's an exciting thought. You know, when just a few weeks ago I was unpacking my books, because I had books in storage for almost 20 years, and I'm pulling them out, and among the books I pulled out were boxes of golden books.
Yeah,
and so that brings me back to your grandfather, because I, as I said, when I read and you write about how he looked and how neat he was and how sort and my father, who served in World War II, also was also in that generation where they dressed so nicely. They looked always so nice with their hats and their, you know, they didn't go anywhere looking like a bum, you know.
No, and
it was so beautiful. And so when I was reading about how your grandfather would spend his money on golden books for you.
Yes.
And there I pulled out my golden books from also many, you know, 20, yes. 30 years ago. It's just a wonderful feeling. And I encourage people to get books for their children.
Right.
And it has a lasting effect.
Right.
So are you involved in programs to encourage children to read and to write?
Yes, I was very, when we established our first book program down here in Mississippi, I was very involved with that, and I'm still very involved with our library programs to encourage children to use the library and to come get books.
Well, I'm so looking forward to meeting you. I will be at the festival, as I said.
Wonderful.
It's a wonderful event here in Tampa, and we get a great turnout. And so the Festival of Reading is going to be on October 24th. It's on a Saturday. It's free. So I encourage everybody to come out and to meet Deborah Johnson and to get her book, The Secret of Magic. And, of course, you have a lovely website. It's called DeborahJohnsonBooks.com. And so everyone who's listening, go to the website and get this wonderful book and come down to the Festival of Reading to meet Deborah. So, Deborah, thank you so much for joining me today.
Patsy, thank you so much. I'm so looking forward to meeting you.
Well, I will be there and getting an autograph. Because I'm a great fan, and you've done a fantastic job. So I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks.
I look forward to seeing you. Yes, thank you so much, and thank you for this interview. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Oh, well, thank you again. So take care, and we'll see you here in Tampa.
We will. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, hi. This is Patsy with a Z, and I just wanted to remind you, as I was mentioning, the wonderful book festival, reading festival that we're going to be having. And I also have coming up in a week an interview with Robin Cook, of course, who wrote Coma. His new book called The Host is equally scary and thrilling, and I hope that you have an opportunity to get his book and read that perhaps before my interview, and join me when I interview him. So this is Patsy with the Z, and I want to thank Big Ed in the control room, who always keeps me going. And remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So get out there and start writing. And then join me next Tuesday for Joy on Paper. Meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it, and have a great week. Bye.